Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. Today is Sunday, January 26, 2025. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater from New Jersey and your moderator for today. The share ID numbers for Friday, January 24th are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,109, that's 22,109. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,110, that's 22,110. This morning, A Vision for You presents, What About Me? Where do I fit in? The promise of the 12-step process is one of a spiritual awakening. A spiritual awakening, according to Appendix 2 of the Big Book, is a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from compulsive overeating. We are able to see, to feel, to know, and to do things we could never do before. Our perspective in life changes. Our distorted view of ourselves and others is transformed. And the result is a new vision, a new being made in the image of God. The self-centeredness of our compulsive overeating brought us little real or lasting pleasure. The rich meaning that we hoped to find in life continued to escape us. Even when we thought we knew best, we were often proven wrong. Trying to have it our way hadn't worked, as the years of unmanageability showed. As we implement these 12 steps, we become established in a new relationship with our higher power of our understanding. We become less and less interested in ourselves, less self-centered, and more interested in what we can contribute to life. There is a natural progression of turning us inside out, from a life-taking habit of self-obsession to a life-giving desire for service to others. We become part of the we. The 12-step recovery process transforms our lives into an extraordinary, powerful journey charged with meaning, charged with purpose, charged with usefulness. Joining us today is Ken W.H., a recovered compulsive overeater from North Carolina. Ken is dedicated to the 12-step design for living, and it's with great pleasure and great appreciation that I welcome Ken to the line. Good morning, Ken. Good morning, Ken. Star one to unmute. Ken.
Ah, there I am.
Welcome. Welcome, my dear friend.
I'll start over. Thank you, Leah, for your introduction, and welcome all to this meeting this morning. Once I get all my buttons pushed, we'll be fine. I mean that in a positive way. I am Ken. I am a recovered compulsive overeater. I live now in North Carolina. For those of you who live in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Kazakhstan, I've claimed some residency there as well. So that may explain some of my accent, that I don't sound like I'm from North Carolina, but that's okay. Here I am nonetheless. I'm grateful to be on the line this morning. This title for the message this morning, which I will get into in just a moment as soon as I offer up a prayer. Just hold on a second. And gracious God, I come to you today and with a simple prayer. May all that I say today honor you in every way. Thank you. What about me? Where do I fit in? I'll tell you a little bit of story about myself, just to claim the space, so to speak. Starts with a little story about Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall, and Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. And all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. And that's the way my story begins. I was Humpty, and I was Dumpty. I was a chubby kid, a nice way of saying a fat kid. Mom used to tell me I had big bones. I don't have big bones, by the way, but that helped. I had big bones, that's why I weighed more. The cute little Pillsbury Doughboy is just so cute in his chubbiness. I wanted to be that little Pillsbury Doughboy and giggle and chuckle when you touched me or poked me in my fat. I wasn't a cute little Pillsbury Doughboy. Like most fat kids, many fat kids that I have known, I was teased and called all kinds of names. Some of them not very pleasant. And I recall vividly the times in junior high and high school going to gym class. And that was a nightmare, a literal nightmare, especially having to take a shower in the boys' locker room with an open shower, no stalls, no nothing else. When we would choose up sides for, let's say, basketball, and how do we differentiate the two teams? Well, one team would take off their shirts. The other team would leave them on, and I prayed. And I prayed hard to be on the shirt team. The last thing in the world I wanted to do was take off my shirt and run up and down a basketball court. And I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed to look at myself in a mirror. I was embarrassed to think what others might see. And I looked and was very, very insecure. And I kept right on eating. For the food didn't call me names. And the food didn't make me dread going to the gym class or taking off my shirt or taking a shower. The food just made me feel okay. Okay in my own eyes, I guess. And that only works so well for so long. Well, one day, Humpty Dumpty did fall, that's Humpty Dumpty, a.k.a. Ken, did fall off the wall. And there were no king's horses and king's men to gather up all the pieces, let alone finding all the pieces. I was broken, and I went into hiding publicly. Oh, what mask will I wear today? Who will I be today as I left home? My favorite mask was whichever one the moment called for. I would be the life of the party if necessary, the jokester, whatever it took to fit into whatever group I was with, no matter the character of that group. I tried to be a friend to everybody, no matter what they were doing, good, bad, or indifferent. Just fit in, Ken. That's what I would say to myself. Just fit in. And maybe they won't notice how fat I am. So I disappeared. I disappeared in the midst of all of that. And I wanted to be someone else. I didn't want to be me. I didn't like myself. And I was sure God didn't. I wanted to be a part of something. And I wanted to be a we. I wanted to be with the in crowd. I wanted to be in with the in crowd. I think of Bill's story and his hanging out at bars and country clubs and putting on the golfer's tan and just being a life of the party, I would imagine, for Bill. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to just be seen differently than I really felt that I was. And I just had no self-esteem. I was ashamed. I just lived in that shame-based life, and it wasn't fun. I would act like I was having fun. I would act like I was in control of myself. I had a distorted way of fitting in and being, so to speak, funny or a jokester. It actually came out more in the form of sarcasm, basically because I my own relationship to myself was so bad that I maybe deep down inside I wanted to hurt myself, but instead I would hurt you with, or anyone, with sarcasm. And if, for those who don't know, sarcasm comes from two Greek words that are put together, sarx and chasm, and it means cutting flesh, literally means to cut flesh. And due to my own insecurity and feeling less than everybody, that was my way of feeling a little more above. I would cut flesh. I would hurt you with my sarcasm. It was biting. It was really nasty at times. And I learned it well, and I used it to my own advantage for many, many years. But there finally came that time when I couldn't fight it anymore, at least to the degree I had been fighting this this self-image fighting, the fat, wanting to be skinny, wanting to be able to run faster, trying to convince myself that I was better at a particular sport than I really was. I was fat. I was overweight all my life that I can remember. I have pictures, and they're hard to look at. At times, they're hard to look at. Today, I can look at them and say, that's not who I am today, and that's the really good news of recovery. But there I was, just eating myself silly, and then I found cigarettes, and then I found booze, and then I found gambling, and then I found all kinds of ways to escape and to move into my secluded private life, turned inward. My first addiction in is food. It's the last one out of all the addictions. I'm not proud that it's the last one out, but I'm so very, very grateful that it is. I couldn't fight anymore. Addiction caught up to me in all of its manifestations. The first to go was alcoholism, then a few more, and finally, compulsive eating. The first addiction in. My recovery journey had begun. I wanted to be a part of AA. I just wanted to be a part of something. I saw joy on the faces of men and women whose bodies had been ravaged by alcohol. And I would kind of think to myself or say, is it okay if I sit here in the back? Is it okay if I come to the meeting? And that was back in 1982. And I took a look at OA in 1984, actually. Fast forward to 2020. And that's about 36 years later. And I still was not abstinent with food. After years of recurrent relapse, over and over and over again. And I'll tell you today, for those out there who are struggling, that relapse is not a requirement for a membership in Overeaters Anonymous. Relapse is not required. And for years, I would just go along to meetings and I would call myself a chronic relapser. And frankly, I was living into that definition of myself. I continued to be a chronic relapser. And I had to come to that place, and I finally did, where I didn't understand myself as a chronic relapser anymore. I didn't identify myself that way. I identified myself as a member of Overeaters Anonymous, not a chronic relapser. I was recovered, finally. And I think maybe that can help some folk to maybe change their sense of identity by not seeing themselves so much as chronic relapsers. I didn't have to see myself that way. And then to move beyond that and move into the chronic recovery, if you will, is what I like to think of today. But I had hit a wall in 2020. Maybe it was the one Humpty Dumpty fell off of. I don't know. I was a spiritual mess, just an absolute spiritual mess. And one day someone mentioned at a face-to-face meeting. Face-to-face meetings are meetings I would go to for years and years and years, not abstinent and not even fully understanding my own abstinence. I would identify myself at those meetings as a sugar-eating, compulsive, recovering overeater. Well, talk about self-deception. That was a biggie for me. Spent years in that and just really didn't have a full grasp of how the big book could work for me with food. Obviously, from 1982, and I've been sober since that date. I have access to, and actually I have all the editions of the big book, but having the big book in my house doesn't mean that I have the big book in my heart and in my brain. And that took an introduction to a vision for you from a friend in a face-to-face who just suggested it. Why don't you give it a try? And I was reluctant at first. I didn't do telephone meetings, we hadn't had COVID yet, and we were still meeting face to face regularly. And I got my hackles up and said, "Oh, telephone meetings can't work. That's not personal enough," and all that kind of stuff. And I was reluctant and resistant. And it took a long time. It was pretty slow coming to appreciate the process of studying in depth the big book that I'd known for so many years, for decades. I'm grateful for that recommendation. So I started coming to the vision meetings, and I went to about some, and then I stopped. I said, "This is silly, one paragraph at a time, it's boring, da-da-da-da-da-da," and I'm going on and on and on, giving myself every excuse not to take advantage of someone's recommendation to help me get better. And but sooner or later, the time came. I go to a meeting every single day. Rarely do I miss a meeting, and if I miss it in real time, I listen to it later on the archive. So I've been going to at least six meetings a week now for 4.5+ years. And wow, I'm not sure what number through the book I am at this point. It may be the fourth, but I was just flabbergasted when I finally really took hold of it. And I started going regularly when you started on the title page. And we started the whole cycle. And I was just startled that that's where you started. I thought, oh my goodness, the title page. But title page mentions being recovered in the past tense. And that's not something I had ever considered in AA or any of the other addictions. I had never considered that idea of being recovered, even though the big book mentions it a number of times early on. And but I missed all that. I missed it. I recall that, you know, starting on page title is not the easiest thing in the world to grasp as necessary. And I think back to my years, early years of recovery in AA. Every meeting I went to, we would read How It Works, that first section of chapter 5, and God could and would if he were sought, ending with that. We would read that at every single meeting. I had it memorized, and it was always an honor to be asked to go up and read that to the group. And there would be 100 people in these groups, and wow. But we'd read this every single meeting, and it was chapter 5. It wasn't until I started on the title page and went through the forwards and then got to the doctor's opinion and Bill's story, and there's a solution and more about alcoholism, and we acknowledge, and oh my goodness. My understanding is that the first printing of the big book, the doctor's opinion, was chapter 1. That meant we went through 1, 2, 3, and 4, the first 4 chapters, so to speak, of the book, which is about a third of the text part, before chapter 5, which is only the third step. So, Ken, what did you miss here? You missed literally 4 chapters of information about the nature of the illness that you have, and that where you need to start with steps 1 and 2, and that you need to be so grounded in them that you can move on to chapter 5. And then on to where the promises are and all that kind of stuff. You got to get settled into this thing, fully embracing the nature of your illness, Ken. So I say all that, and then I say, so what's that got to do with the topic today? Yeah, and you may have noticed that I'm telling my story. I'm speaking about myself in the first person singular. I've been telling my story, and even if some of among you may be able to relate to this, that, or the other thing that I say, I'm still just telling my story, not your story, not your story. I can't tell your story. I can't tell anybody else's story. I can only tell mine. I can't speak of your spiritual condition. I can speak of mine. And so where do I fit in? Well, I fit into my story of addiction and recovery, not yours. That's where I fit into my story to begin with. And to remember that it's my story that I'm telling. And if I get into speaking about you in my story, I've kind of moved off the beam. I'm kind of starting to fall away. I'm looking in the wrong direction. The big book tells me that our stories, disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. And Bill, in the writing of this, is referring to the first 100 or so recovering people. He's speaking of them as a collective, a we. However, Bill tells his story in the first person singular. Go to chapter 1. And I found that so do the folk in the first four, it found in the rest of the book, the other 400 pages of the book with the personal stories in the back of the book there. Look at it. Leaf through that and tell me how many eyes you see on the page. They're telling their story. They're not talking about me. They're telling their story so that I might be able to relate in some way and receive something from them, receive some experience, strength, and hope, receive information that I need to recover, and to put aside, maybe store some information that I don't agree with, but I may need it someday. Who knows? Take what you like, store the rest. Don't leave it. Store it. You may need it. Who knows? Even if you totally disagree at the moment, I have come to understand that I've been wrong at times. And I know that's hard to believe, but I have been wrong at times. And that was hard to come to terms with, be perfectly honest with you. Don't you know that I know? And took a long time to come to the place where I could say that you know when you know that you don't know. And that was a tough one for me. Anyway, those stories compiled become a part of a collective we. I hear in so many meetings, and I hear it often, that this is a we program. And it's become a sort of a slogan. And for myself, I need to be careful with a slogan that I might use. It just may not say exactly what I want it to say. It may not say enough. It may even take some finagling on my part to try to understand it for myself. Some slogans have been helpful, and some, frankly, have not. So I need to be careful with what they say. And that's where my title of this message comes from. If this is a we program, where do I fit in? Where do I belong? What about me? What about the I that is present in the midst of these collective we's that we talk about and that I hear people share about so much? A good example of a slogan or a phrase that doesn't work for me is that there but for the grace of God go I. Well, the more and more I thought about that, I thought to myself, wait a minute. What about all the other poor people out there, the poor overeaters out there who aren't getting any grace? But I got it, and they didn't get the grace. I don't understand that. Well, I've come to understand that grace is there for everybody. And it's because of the grace of God that I can go anywhere and be of service to anyone, to even think about other people because of the grace of God. Not because of the grace of God, I would be there in that place with them without the grace of God. No. Because of the grace of God, I got to go there. I got to go to the folk who are still suffering. I got to go and carry the message. And so for me, it's a we program is fine to a point. What has helped me tremendously, and maybe this can help some other people. This just came to me actually not too long ago. And it's helped me a lot. It's to understand we and our a little differently. I imagine reading that portion of the big book as follows, where it says our stories disclose in a general way. I like to read it as each one of our stories disclose in a general way what each one of us used to be like, what happened to each one of us, and what each one of us is like now. That's using the we and understanding we collectively, yet the story I tell is not our story, it's mine. And my story and your story and your story and your story come together and create and become a part of the larger story of recovery that is OA. And then I can start speaking in terms of a we that does not speak for each individual, but a we that is this collective of all of these beautiful, beautiful individuals with stories, and some are just jaw droppers, but these incredible stories and these incredibly unique, beautiful individuals made in the image of God, as I understand it, and have beautiful stories of recovery to share. I don't want to lose that individuality that is so special in each of our stories. And so it helps me to say that each one of us, truth be told, and this is just for me, the only thing that I can say about we or us is that as a member of OA, we have declared that we have a desire to stop eating compulsively. If we haven't claimed that, we're really not a part or a member of Overeaters Anonymous. We have to have that desire to even begin to find our way in with this in crowd of recovering people. I have not been anorexic or bulimic. I just ate. I have no idea what that was like for anybody. Only each individual anorexic or bulimic can tell his or her personal story. We, as a collective fellowship, cannot do that. That's just my belief. I think about step 10, that I 10 and 11, but 10 especially, where it says that this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory. Well, wait a minute. I can't take yours. I spent a lot of years taking yours, your inventory, and anybody else that I could think of, so that I could avoid taking my own. So the we there is, again, that each one of us continues to take personal, my personal inventory, and continue to set right any new mistakes as I go along. They're not your mistakes. You as don't have to correct my mistakes. You can't. So again, there's this sense of in the midst of this collective we call OA, there are each of these individuals, including myself, who are doing what the steps recommend as suggestions. Ha ha. Yes, recommendations. But I have to do, I have to pick up the big book. I have to write out my inventory, not yours. I have to sit down with God and someone else and myself and share that inventory. I've got to make amends for my mistakes. So I think I that makes the point. So I get back to Humpty and his dumptiness, and where does he fit in? And, well, frankly, for me, he doesn't anymore. I never wanted to be a big, fat egg anyway. Once I finally worked the steps and followed directions and cleared away the wreckage of the past, including cleaning up all of the broken pieces of my shell mixed up in that gooey yolk albumin mixture. Ugh, what a mess. And finally had a spiritual awakening and got off the bozo bus to help someone who believes they are a clown and will always be a clown like I used to be. My God doesn't see me that way. That's maybe another one of those slogans or things, little phrases we hear. I'm just another bozo on the bus. And when I hear that, I just cringe. I was a bozo. I'm not a bozo anymore. And I'm not riding the same bus with bozos. I had to let that go. And I had to let the go that, oh, the humor that maybe was intended behind that of this busload of clowns doing their best to get through life. That wasn't helpful for me anymore. I didn't need to see myself that way. God showed me that I didn't need to see myself that way anymore. A bozo fumbling his way through life as a clown. And I don't believe that God sees the suffering compulsive eater that way either. I'm convinced that the God of my understanding loves the bozos on the bus enough to get us off the bus and to get us out into the world with others who aren't on the bus, who haven't jumped aboard and claimed a seat yet. So that's again, everything you're hearing today is my personal opinion, and you can do with it what you will. I hope you can store some of it. You might need it later, but in the midst of this vast fellowship, I must not lose sight of what I need to do and be to maintain a fit spiritual condition with God. You, and that's all of you, cannot do that for me. Yes, do service. And don't get lost in it. I listened to an archive special edition yesterday, and the person talked about having extensive years of recovery, and did service all the way up the ladder, trustee, the whole thing, and after 17 years, relapsed and came back. So, you know, this person basically said, stop doing the things she needed to do. She didn't even finish the steps and was into service. So be careful. That's what I had to learn. Do the service, but don't get lost in it. Don't let it become, I had to say to myself, don't let it become me. I needed to be a part of it, one among many, in it. I've heard it said that one of my character defects, and I've heard it said in a collective as well, that all alcoholics, all OA members are terminally unique. No, I'm not. I'm not terminally unique. The God of my understanding has brought me to a place and shown me what my God thinks of me, so that I can see myself positively as being eternally unique. That God has always wanted the best for me, has always wanted me to be healthy and whole and at peace with myself, and to stop talking negatively about myself and thinking negatively about myself. Oh my gosh, what a process that has been. God thinks I'm special. And I believe that God thinks every one of you is special. And he doesn't think any less of each one of us. Each one of us is special, I believe, in God's sight. And I thank God for the grace to carry the message of recovery to others. I don't have to. I don't have to. But I find that I cannot not do it. It's not that I have to. I just want to. I just want to. In response to the incredible grace that is there for everybody, I believe, but that has been poured out on me. poured out on Humpty Dumpty before he even knew he was Humpty Dumpty. That grace has made it possible for me to have a story to share that someone else, one other person might possibly reap a benefit, come to a better understanding, a healthy understanding of each one of them, each one of their selves. That's all I'm here for, is to carry that message that's been so freely given to me. The doctor's opinion told me that I could not safely serve myself more food. Now, I cannot not serve up my story, my experience, strength, and hope with others, so that each one of us can feel a part of this beautiful collective that we call Overeaters Anonymous. So grateful to be with you today, and thank you for listening, and I pass.
Thank you so much, Ken, for this beautiful, authentic presentation this morning. Such a beautiful and profound presentation indeed. Share ID for today, 22,111. That's 22111 for Ken's presentation this morning. Ken's contact information will be given at the conclusion of the recording, so do stay tuned for that. We will now transition to a question answer segment. You can pose a question to Ken by pressing star 1 to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name. Questions only, of course.
Herbert F.
Herbert. Star 1 to unmute. All right, well, let's get
Karen
started
K.
with Karen K. Thank you.
Janice M. in Pennsylvania.
Janice M.
Kathy K. from Boston.
Gotcha, Kathy. Thank you.
Krista S. from Illinois.
Krista F.
Anayeta R. from Texas.
Got you. Yes. All right, let's get started with this group, beginning with Herbert F., followed by Karen K. Go ahead, Herbert.
Good morning. Thank you, Leah, and thank you, Ken. I want to say that then you and I had the same experience in our boyhood in playing sports, for sure. But I wanted to ask, do you believe that there's any such thing as a yellow light food? Similar question, do you believe that there's any such thing as a slip? Thanks very much for your service, everyone. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Herbert. Interesting questions. I did. I used to believe that I had my green, yellow, red light food list, and I came to a place eventually where I found that to be counterproductive for me. It just helped me to keep fooling myself. And this is just for me. I had foods on my yellow list that today are on my red list. The truth be known is they should have always been on the red list. But they were foods that I hadn't gotten to the place of being ready to let go yet. And I was toying with them. And that's not a good place for me to be with food. Making decisions about whether or not this was a good time to have a particular food, how much of it, and I needed to let that go. So today, it's either a trigger food, it either sets me off or it doesn't. And I try to stay within those boundaries. There are certain foods and food types that I know just set me off if I get started. So I don't do them. That's just the bottom line now. As far as slips are concerned, I've always had this picture of a slip. It's sort of like a normal person who doesn't have an issue with banana peels on a sidewalk will be walking down the sidewalk and see that banana peel and step around it and continue on. Me, as an addict, a person that is so sure of himself and in control, will go and say, there's a banana peel. I'm going to step on it, and this time I'm not going to fall on my butt. And sure enough, I go and step on it, and there I am on my butt. If that describes a slip, that's the way I understand it. I chose to step onto that banana peel and fall on my butt. So I'm not so sure slip is something that just kind of happens as much as something that I do. And a whole lot of circumstances and everything else can lead me to that place of feeling so confident I can step on it that sure, yeah, why not? Let's have some. I don't call that a slip per se. That's just letting go of the program for me. Hope that helps.
Thank you, Herbert F. Karen K., your turn.
Good morning, Kevin. Good morning, Leah, and thank you for your service. Ken, it was really nice to hear, a voice I haven't heard in a long time, so it's always nice to hear a fresh voice. You closed your talk with, and I was wondering if you could just be a little bit more define it for me, because I never want to assume what you said. I know a lot, for the doctor's opinion, I can no longer serve up my food or meal, and my story, I can no longer serve up. So if you could be a little bit precise on that for me, because that was very catchy. I like that. So I don't want to assume, but if you could kind of clearly define that for me. Thank you very much, Ken.
Okay. Thank you, Karen. Maybe it'll become a slogan. I don't know. all I really meant to say was, yeah, it was, I was playing with my my own words a little bit there, suggesting that the doctor's opinion told me that I have an allergy and a compulsion of the mind, and that if basically if I put certain things into my body, the allergy kicks in and I'm off and running, and I have no more control over what I'm going to eat than the man on the moon. And that's that sense where I am not able to serve myself. The doctor's opinion tells me that if I serve myself certain foods, I'm off to the races. And then I wanted to say that in recovery, as a recovered person, I can now freely serve up service. I can serve up the message of hope and recovery, the good news that I've gotten by being a member of Overeaters Anonymous and doing the steps and all of that stuff. So that's what I really meant by that, that compulsive, if you will, behavior of serving myself up food has basically been transformed to a compulsive desire to help others and to share the message of hope. I hope that helps.
Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Karen Kay. Janice M., your turn.
Hi, Ken. Hi, Maya. This is Janice M. in Pennsylvania. Thanks so much, Ken. Oh, my gosh. Thank you for that visual about the banana peel. That was great. And I also want to thank you for sharing your personal feelings about individual sayings and stuff like that. It was kind of refreshing. But I wanted to ask you, you had mentioned other addictions. I don't know if you're in those fellowships, but I'm in different fellowships for addictions. I was wondering if you are, what does that look like logistically, like just on a practical basis, you know, as service, you know, that kind of thing, meetings?
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
I'm not sure. And for when you said, how's that statistically, is that what you said? Or?
Oh, no, logistically.
Logistically.
Like logistically.
Yeah, got it. Well, I just simply say that right now in my life, my major concentration is on food and recovery in OA. It's frankly the newest. I've been abstinent for 4.5 years now. I've been sober for over 40. In a sense, God removed that addiction from me. And while I have not discarded my relationship to AA, I focus my attention today on OA recovery and specifically the study of the Big Book. It helps me to study it from the OA perspective because it taught me so much that I didn't I hate to use the word ingest over the years of AA. I missed so much. I got sober and I stayed sober and it worked, but I still didn't have a full grasp with respect to food, the whole issue in the doctor's opinion and the first 4 chapters of the book. I don't know if that answers your question so much as to say that my focus today is on OA, which is the most current growth area in my life. So hope that helps.
Thank you, Janice M. Kathy K.
Thank you, Leia, for your service. And thanks, Ken, so much for your talk today. I wanted to ask you if you'd be willing to reflect on how your spiritual practice is different today than when you were a newcomer, say, and what you do on a daily basis to stay connected to your higher power.
Oh, thank you, Kathy. wow, I could spend an hour talking about that. It's been one of those radical rearrangements in my life over the last 5 years, especially, for sure. Yes, getting into recovery to begin with was a radical shift for me. I came in reasonably agnostic. I was scared to death to be an atheist, to be honest with you. And because I grew up with a lot of religious information that was fine. I mean, I didn't have any qualms. But when I got loose, so to speak, off the college, I was gone. I was running, and I didn't darken a door for a long time of a church or anything related to religion. So my spiritual life was zip. I didn't have one. My spiritual life was actually a spirit's life, if you will, taking in a lot of spirits and living my life that way, taking in extreme amounts of food, just self-indulgence like crazy. Got into recovery, and I started to understand better how much I needed a power greater than myself to solve this problem, like it tells me in the big book. And so I started to have another way of looking at or understanding this power. And it took me back to what I already knew and had learned, and to some degree, and embraced it in a different light and from a different direction. Today, I have a personal relationship with the God of my understanding in a specific, or maybe not specific way, but in a particular way that's identifiable by a name. But that's not what's important. What's important is that I have that relationship and maintain it on a daily basis. So my mornings are spent with prayer. My wife and I pray together. I have my own series of exercises. It includes reading portions of another book and every day, and being in prayer and taking inventory at night. And actually through the day, I have my phone set to go off 3 times a day, which is just the way to stop me in my tracks and say, okay, whoa, yeah, you're real busy, but, or, and, are you doing what you need to do? Are you in a good place? Are you spiritually fit right now? And that also occurs when I'm moving into food situations. I plan ahead so that I don't have to make those decisions in the moment, because I'm not good at it. And God is with me for that. I'll invite the God of my understanding to come in there with me and to keep me on track, to stay on plan. So, yeah, there's constant contact, constant conscious contact with the God of my understanding. I am blessed to have that today. I have studied much about God and learned a lot, so to speak. But that's not the same as actually having a personal, conversational relationship with a God of my understanding. Hope that helps.
Thank you, Kathy K. Next up, Krista F.
Hey, Herbert, thank you for your service. I love how you talked about people forgetting to do or be the people that they like in order to recover. I'm wondering if you could elaborate on that a bit. What do you think people forget to do the most, like when they get lost in service and when it comes to their own like individual spiritual practices?
Again, thank you, Krista, for the question. I really can't speak for other folk specifically. I just know that, how do I want to say it? There were times in my early years of recovery in AA where I did service. I served on a local board and all that kind of thing. And I still wasn't the nicest person to be around. I hadn't changed much. I hadn't developed a strong spiritual connection at that point. I had some relationship to a power greater than myself, but I wasn't allowing that to change my character. So I could describe myself as a dry drunk at times, where there's no booze around, but I'm behaving like there is. And I've done that. I did that for years in OA. I didn't have a developed relationship to the God of my understanding, but I was treasurer for years in different groups. I would be a treasurer or lead a meeting and all those kinds of things. But I wasn't in at the same time developing my own spiritual condition or maintaining my spiritual condition and improving my conscious contact with God as I understand him by prayer and meditation. I hadn't moved into that 11th step work, that 11th step process of improving my conscious contact on a daily basis. I wasn't doing that. And it's easy for me to be distracted away from that. Anything can distract me. And service is one of those things that can. Because I can convince myself that I'm involved in OA, I'm involved in the program, I'm doing what they tell me to do from the 12th step, I'm carrying the message, but what message am I carrying? I wasn't carrying the message of experience, strength, and hope with respect to improving my conscious contact. It was somewhat of an empty message that I was carrying because it didn't have that component that cannot be left out, in my opinion. And maybe that's what I'm trying to say more than anything else, that service, as good as it is, and working with others as important as it is, can be a distraction, and was for me, and I've heard other people speak of it that way too. I hope that's helpful, Krista.
Thank you, Krista F. Hanayeta R., your turn to pose a question.
Good morning, Elaya, for your service, and Ken W.H. I love listening to you share all the time. This is, like, amazing. I really related to what you're saying, almost all of it, especially the shower and being on a team. let me ask, the question I have for you is the WE program.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, if that was meaning that we can't do it alone, that I can't tell your story, just like you said, but I can't do it alone, that we need each other in order to recover? That's my view on the WE program. I don't know how you relate to that.
Mm-hmm. I'm not a one to throw babies out with bathwater. And I'm not saying in any way to do away with the idea of we. We are a we, a collective we. And it's just, as much as anything, my point to be made is that you can't have a we unless you have two. It takes two, one, two, to make a we. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any we's. But the fact is that all of us individually together become a we. And that allowed Bill to speak, and, you know, using that imagery, allowed Bill to speak in terms of we throughout the book when he gets through his story. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are 100 men and women, more than 100 men and women who have solved their problem and recovered from alcoholism. That's speaking in terms of the whole group, and each individual in it is a part of that that first 100, all of their stories. And you read the stories in the back, and they're different. There aren't two stories that are the same. They're all different. They're individual stories. And you can go back to the first edition when they had, I don't even know if they've carried one forward other than Bill's story or Dr. Bob's nightmare. But there were different stories, and all of those stories are important to make up this collective we that is called Overeaters Anonymous, because we are facing a common problem, with a common solution as we understand it in Overeaters Anonymous. By identifying myself as a member of Overeaters Anonymous, I have a desire to stop eating compulsively, and I am assuming that everybody else at the meeting is wanting the same thing. And then in that sense, we are all striving to be different than we have been in relationship to our addictions. How we've lived out those different addictions is what makes our personal stories important to each other. But they're also important to the collective whole, so that I can identify in certain places, not entirely, but that I can have conversation with other people in this program and listen and learn and gather all of the. That's why I say take what I like and store the rest. I'm listening and I'm hearing what's helpful for me, and I'm also hearing what at the moment doesn't sound like it fits, but who knows when it will, and it may. And that's the we part. That's the gathering all the information that we have to offer one another and the support that we have to offer one another, and using that to our advantage in our personal recovery and our personal relationship with a power greater than ourselves, which how many of us can really identify specifically with each other's relationship to a higher power? We can't. I mean, they're all so different. But they do create this environment of belonging to something bigger than us, bigger than me. And I hope that's helpful. That's a kind of a long answer to maybe a shorter question.
Thank you, Hanayeta R. We still have time for questions. You can do so, pose a question by pressing star 1 to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name.
Claire J. from Pennsylvania.
Claire J.
Natalie,
Kate from Massachusetts.
I think I heard a Natalie. Kate.
S. from Indiana. Thank you.
Anyone else? Star 1 to unmute.
Ken, this is Alexis from New Jersey.
Okay, Alexis.
Hi.
Mm-hmm. One moment, Alexis. We're taking a list. Thank you.
Victoria L.
Anyone else? I'm Victoria L. Okay, let's go forward with this. We have Claire, Natalie, Kate, Alexis, and Victoria. Claire, go ahead with your question, please.
Thank you, Leah, and thank you, Ken, for your story. It resonated with me profoundly. My question is, if I understand your story correctly, you started out in life as a compulsive overeater, and then other addictions were part of your story, and you achieved sobriety, or however you wish to call it, abstinence in those addictions, and then eventually food was the focus of your recovery. And what was the role that food played while you were recovering in those other addictions, and why do you think it is that food was the last addiction to go?
Oh, my. That's a good question. I think the thing with that made food so difficult for me is that I had to keep eating it. You know, with alcohol, you put the plug in the jug, and you don't have to pull the plug out ever again, because my body does not need alcohol to survive. I put down the deck of cards and stopped gambling, and I didn't ever have to pick up the cards again. I didn't need gambling to survive in my life. But food, what am I going to do? I just can't throw it all out into the dumpster and have an empty refrigerator and expect to live terribly long. So I had to eat something. And that's where my ego, my self-centered self could express itself and continue to express itself in a negative way in my life, in this whole thing of, well, I have to decide what to eat. How am I going to do that? I've not been very successful at that all of my life. I've never, most of my life, I didn't even think about how much I was eating, or even what I was eating. I didn't care. I just wanted to eat. And it wasn't until I got into recovery that I started to understand a little bit better that it wasn't all food that was doing this for me. It wasn't all food that I craved to eat constantly. There were certain foods that touched stuff off for me and kind of lit the fuse. And then the ball was rolling, the allergy kicked in, and away we go. And it took time for me and a lot of help from some other people, help in the sense of, are you sure, Ken, that that's good for you? You know, asking me those pointed questions rather than saying, you shouldn't eat that. Rather than doing that, people would ask me the question, what do you think about what you're eating? And I had to really start to look closely at what I was doing with food and which foods and why I was eating particular foods and what they were doing for me or not doing for me. So that's, I think, for me, that's what made some of it more difficult. The other part of it is, I think a part of me just didn't want to. I mean, everything else was going out the door. I have to give up that too? Well, I've come to learn that it isn't a matter of giving things up. It's a matter of letting them go and understanding that they're just not good for me. And knowing that the God of my understanding wants the best for me, and that God has suggested to me at times through other people, you know, asking the question, Ken, do you think that's really good for you? Are you kidding yourself here? And then I would have to look at it and maybe let go of something else and be at peace with that. And the letting go is an easier concept to think of than I can't, or I got to give up. That's me giving it up. Letting it go is opening my hand and giving it to God and saying, let me know where we are with this, oh God, you know, show me the way with this particular food that maybe I'm struggling with or fighting. The big book says, it says, we ceased fighting everything and everyone. Have each individual needs to ask themselves that question. What am I still fighting? I hear people say on the line, I'm struggling with. And I heard somebody once say, if you're struggling with, stop it. Stop struggling. You're fighting it. Let go. And let God have at it. And so, you know, if it's struggling with something, it's trying to say something. If I'm struggling with something, it's trying to tell me something. And I need to look at that closely. So that's all I have on that, I think. Thanks for your question.
Thank you, Claire. Natalie, your turn.
Thank you, Leah. And as everyone has said, thank you, Ken. This is Natalie S. in Indiana. So, my connection to the We of Overeaters Anonymous manifests itself in anorexia and in compulsive exercise. And my question is, if you would describe in your peacefulness now, I hear a lot of acceptance and surrender, and I'd like to know more about your journey of accepting where God has you, you know, 8 years ago, 5 years ago, yesterday, and surrendering those new things to Him in peace. So that's my question. Thank you.
thank you. I'd like to say that every time I let go, it was all peacefulness. But the fact is, I still have an ego. I still have times where I think differently than what God does, which is not a good plan. It's not a good idea. I don't recommend that to anybody, to disagree with God. But I think over time, the more and more I've just simply let go, the more peaceful I get. It happens every day to some degree, I think. There are certain, you know, I have a brain, it works, and stuff goes on around all the time. There's information going through my brain all the time. And I have opinions about a lot of things that go through my mind. And what I've come to understand is that I have nothing to win there. There is no prize for having my opinion accepted by the world, or my opinion accepted by anybody else for that matter. It's mine. And I've come to terms with not needing any longer to prove myself right all the time and to make you understand the way I understand something. I don't have to do that anymore. God has shown me that that was a part of my old self. That's what I needed to do in the past. I needed to feel better than. I needed to feel better than I felt about myself. And I don't have to do that anymore. In absolute recovery, in being recovered, I just understand myself so differently in the eyes of God that I don't have that need anymore to prove anything, to say that I'm right. Everything I shared today is just my opinion, and I know a lot of people don't agree with it. And that's fine. That's okay. I don't have to get everybody on board with me. I'm just at peace with that. That I've come far enough in life now that I'm on the other end of it, so or heading towards the other end of it, and I just don't no longer want to invest the time and effort it takes to be something I'm not. So it's accepting who I am today, and it's good. And it's good. Like I said in the talk, I mean, God thinks I'm special. Even when I don't think I'm special, God thinks I am. And God thinks you are, and everybody else is too. It just takes so much work for me to have accepted that and to understand it. And that helps me now let go of stuff. It's just the fact that God thinks I'm special is enough. That's enough today. I hope that helps in some way. I don't know if I got off track, but I probably did. It's okay.
Thank you, Natalie, for your question. Kate, your turn.
Okay. Hi, I'm Kate, compulsive, and I always call myself an emotional overeater because there are things I could eat when I am in the emotional state that become problematic and something that I eat when I'm not. And so the whole idea of emotional sobriety. And so my question is, I had a situation yesterday where I had to step out of my car, and there's treated road, and there was ice in certain spots, so I couldn't walk without touching ice somewhere and wondering if I was going to slip. And I think of the program as more that way as opposed to the banana peel. And so based on that, how do you deal with the emotional sobriety of all of the broken, you know, like once you're put together, but they're still navigating life on life's terms, that expression, and not have something that takes the edge off, that is more tangible? That's my question.
Interesting question, yes. well, my first part of response is being abstinent from the foods that trigger me. I no longer have to take the edge off. I don't sense that in me that my emotions are at a place that the only way I can deal with them is take the edge off. I have other ways now of dealing with the feelings that come up, and I can deal with other people freely now because I'm not ashamed of my feelings like I used to be. When I had to take the edge off, when I would get so angry but be so afraid to express it that I would have to take the edge off. Today, I have ways of dealing with the emotions that come, people I can talk to and share with, and especially God. I never took these things to God before. I never shared what I was feeling, and that's part of what my three my phone remembering technique is about. How am I feeling? Am I mad? Am I aggravated? Am I feeling elated? Ridiculously elated about something, which was another way to trigger. If I want to speak in terms of emotional triggers, but I think more than anything, and maybe this is helpful. This is another one of those slogans. Actually, it's something that came out of one of the stories in the back of the book about living life on life's terms. I could go off on that. That's another one of the slogans that I don't care for, particularly. Not that it's bad. It's just that I sometimes life just stinks. It's bad. It's ugly. There's ugly stuff going on in the world and around us. And friends die, and people die, and family dies, and da-da-da-da-da, everything. We get diseases. We have the IRS come after us, all kinds of stuff. And that's life. And if I live on those terms, that life's terms of all of that stuff that's going out there, I'm going to be a mess. So what I like to say for myself is that today I live life on God's terms. And that's what I'm after. What are God's terms for my life? Even in the midst of a mess or LA fires or whatever, even in the midst of that, what does God have for me? How does God want me to live in the midst of that? That's more important to me than trying to understand my life in terms of that life out there. That's real. It's happening. It's for sure. But how does God want me to see that and live in it? That's what's most important to me today. Hope that's helpful. Leah.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Ken. Our final question for this morning comes from Alexis. Your question, please, Alexis.
Good morning, Leah and Ken. Thank you for your service. Could you please tell me, Ken, what your conscious contact with God, how long does it, with your conscious contact with God, how long did it take before you had two-way conversation and had that? Are you talking about the spiritual experience when you say change of character?
Mm. Yeah.
And another part to the question is, how long do you still continue to get some negative thoughts?
Yes. That's part of wearing this skin, what we call human. I think, sure, I get them. And I need to get rid of them, take care of them pretty quickly, because the negative thoughts don't fare well in my brain. As far as conscious contact and understanding that, I know people have talked about two-way prayer, and I'm not sure what the origin of that particularly is, but two-way prayer has been going on for millennia. That's just a way back thing of speaking to God and listening. It's a two-way conversation. I've always understood it in that way. I haven't always been very good at it. Usually it's because I don't listen well. if there are things that God says to me and I'm saying, are you kidding? Is it, can I get another opinion? And God laughs and chuckles and said, no, Ken, this is it. And go give it a try and it's going to be good for you. I believe that today, that a part of that conversation is me listening better, but then also knowing better and learning better what it is that I'm really wanting to ask or wanting to say to God, what I really need to say to God at particular times, rather than let's talk about baseball or something. You know, it's not that kind of a conversation. It's an intentional conversation. It's part of a conversation that comes with having a covenant kind of relationship with God and trusting that whatever is in that conversation is confidential to begin with between God and myself, and that if I listen carefully enough and open-mindedly enough, freely enough, trusting God enough that it's in my best interest, I will follow what I receive in that two-way conversation. That prayer has been going on for millennia. People have been crying out to God. God has been speaking, and people haven't listened and have gone different ways. That's been my story, too. But today, I'm just tired of fighting all that. So today, I just let God be God and do my best to say, okay, I trust you. Let's go on. That's all I have. Thanks.
Thank you, Alexis, and thanks to everyone who posed questions this morning. And, of course, thank you so much, Ken, for your beautiful and rich, deep share this morning. It's been very special to spend this time with you. The share ID for today, 22,111. That's 22111. And we're going to close the meeting this morning on page 164 from a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until.